Hello and welcome to the British Chamber of Commerce Singapore's podcast channel. With over 15,000 downloads since launch, we are excited to bring you Season 4 featuring in-depth content on business, global affairs and news across Singapore, ASEAN and the United Kingdom. We've had some extraordinary guests on our channel, including W Series driver Abby Eaton.
I've got thoughts for the future now. I'd love to try and kind of mentor some of the younger drivers, you know.
Renowned UK international education champion, Professor Sir Steve Smith.
Over about a four-year period, we kept increasing the resources going into mental health provision.
Chief Executive and Director of the London Design Museum, Tim Marlowe.
The way we design is actually thinking about the needs of everyone.
And CEO of the industry cluster group at JTC, Alvin Tan.
If you look at TDD, we are creating an ecosystem of companies, government agencies and industry associations in the digital space.
Thank you, as always, for your continued support, and I hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to our podcast, Bridging the Sustainability Gap. I'm Lorena Paglia. I'm on the board of the British Chamber of Commerce in Singapore. I'm also the co-chair of the Sustainability Committee. I have a background in disruptive transformation and sustainability, and I work at Microsoft as the Business Operations Manager for Data and AI. As part of this series, I will interview companies on the work that they undertake across sustainability development, industry transition, and the ways in which this impact is helping to bridge the sustainability gap. As part of this, we will talk about the sustainable economy and what this means across finance investment, carbon development, and mass industry transition, the gaps that we have in sustainability, and how individuals, industries, and businesses are driving impact to bridge that gap. The reality is, this is not easy, and no one can do this on their own. The aim of this podcast is to celebrate great work that is being done, be open about the realities of the challenges that exist, and explore the ways in which these gaps are being addressed, bringing our listeners on a learning journey on what is in progress and what more can be done to bridge the sustainability gap. Joining me today is a guest who, in many ways, is a pioneer in sustainability. He's been working in strategic sustainability long before many knew what sustainability truly meant, working with some of the largest and most impactful global companies. He's founded his own sustainability consultancy, Roberts Bridge, in 2010, back in London, employing some of the most prominent environmental thinkers of our time. Today, they have offices across Dubai, Singapore, and Jakarta, and have also merged with Stonehaven, which is also a very impressive outfit on its own. So without further ado, thank you, Brendan May, for joining us today. It is such an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. Really nice to be here, Lorena.
I want to just add a side note to the listeners who are joining us today. So for a really long time, you can probably tell from my intro that I've been a huge fan of Roberts Bridge work. So I've been following them for a while. And namely because as a consultancy, they have a great deal of independence where they also need to be driving real transformation in this space. So that often means that as a company that they're working with some really difficult and controversial industries as well, but with the intent of driving and challenging these businesses to change for good and for the better. And part of that involves having some really difficult conversations and also at times it brings some controversy. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. But that brings me first to you, Brendan, and starting with the you. I'm always really curious about people who lean into the messy, into the risky, into the challenging. And what's often on the other side of that then is some of these big market impacting changes that we really need to bring about in the sustainability space. So I'd love to understand what's your why and what made you want to tackle sustainability long before anyone even understood the importance of it.
It's a really, it's a big question. I think for me, my interest in sustainability was sort of lit when I briefly worked as a political researcher in the British Parliament back in the late 90s. And I didn't like or enjoy party politics at all, but I liked politics with a small p. And one of the people I was working with had been an environment minister and said, you know, if you like politics but don't like party politics, you know, the environment is the place to be because it's highly political. It's the issue of our time, and I think you'll enjoy it. And that's really how I ended up going into the environment, because it was a very frontline issue even then, not to the extent that it is now. I started in marine conservation in fisheries, which was an issue I'd never really considered, but I was recruited to go in there by this former minister who had become chairman of a marine conservation organization. And I immediately found it fascinating because I was acting as a bridge, really, between fishing organizations, supermarket chains, big seafood companies, NGOs, business-friendly NGOs, anti-business NGOs. So it was a bit like being dropped into the whole sector, you know, all at once, and understanding all the politics that goes on these issues. And ever since, it's been the same, whether you're talking about palm oil or deforestation issues or certification systems, you know, or mining or energy. And they all have these ecosystems of politicians, governments, businesses, NGOs, investors now increasingly. And I just think it's a really interesting place to be, apart from the fact that it is obviously the most important challenge of our age.
You know what I really love about what you're just explaining is the pathway that you got into it, right? Because one of the biggest questions that I get asked all the time is from people that are coming into the sustainability space now is, how do I get involved? What do I need to do? How do I need to upskill myself? And I think one of your story is a really great way that explains, do you know what? There's no one pathway that takes us into this sustainable world. You are also a great example of getting straight into the nitty gritty and the stickiness of some of the challenges that we have in the background. So thank you for sharing that.
I would say, I mean, it's changed, of course, a lot. I mean, that was sort of late 90s, whereas now there's much more structure. Virtually every university offers, you know, some degree course in some element of sustainability or responsible business. And, you know, I always say to people, if you want to get into it now, you've either got to really know something. So you've got to be an expert on a particular part of the sustainability agenda or a particular sector. You know, or you've got to have done some sort of qualification, you know, whereas in my day, it just wasn't the case. It was a very ad hoc. So people sort of fell into it. It's a little bit harder to do that now. What I find really interesting as well is the number of people who want to change into sustainability mid-career. And that really didn't apply to me because I was at the very beginning of mine when I was lucky enough to find myself working in it.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a really good point, because even for me, a lot of the research was done through my customers and clients at the time and being able to investigate those gaps. But you're right, now we have to get through a more structured environment into it. The biggest thing I say to people that are mid-career that do want to make the shift is they're really focusing on their transferable aspects of it or what they can do within the sphere of the industry that they're in or their career path that they're in to be able to have that impact as well. So I want to switch into challenging the status quo, because we talked about your political career. We've talked about the reasons why and what led you on this pathway. A big part of sustainable development, and perhaps the most challenging part of it too, is really leaning into those challenging industries that really needed to change to make them better, to make them more sustainable and to make them more accountable. So what has been yours and also Robert's Bridge ethos in driving sustainable change here? And what are some of the guiding principles that you might think about when you're working with some of these industries?
I think we quite early on developed an ethos which was about challenging the way the client was framing its ambitions or desires. You know, in the early days, it was very much risk avoidance. It was, you know, can you help us, you know, tick these boxes? And, you know, we're a bit worried about this NGO or that. It was quite reactive. So it was not very focused on the enormous commercial opportunities that exist in being a leader on sustainability. And a lot of those firms were drawn initially to the legal industry or the PR industry to sort of defend their interests. There's nothing worse than trying to sue an NGO. Even if you're right, it's a terrible look and you will not win in the court of public opinion. There's also nothing worse than a company that's up against it, thinking that shouting and shouting and shouting through PR and advertising about how green you are will in some way win the argument for you, because it simply won't. And I had done a stint in the communications industry after I left the Marine Stewardship Council. And it struck me and my business partner, Christopher, who'd spent 35 years in PR, that what those companies do is they sit in front of a client and they come in and they go, the answer's yes, what's the question? And this is not a way to manage sustainable development or any form of serious interventions on these issues. And we started saying, look, we think you're asking the wrong questions. And people would invite us to pitch for RFPs. And we was like, we're not going to pitch for that RFP. It's completely, it's not going to deliver what you want, you know. And some people said, thanks very much, goodbye. But actually most were like, oh, tell me more about that. And because a lot of us had come from the environmental campaigning world, you know, they sort of knew that we were saying to them things that they would be told in public, but we were saying it in private. And that's really, I think, how we started to build the trust of these companies that we started working with. And I think that, yeah, we do lots of things now. We do what you might call quite traditional management consultancy type sustainability advice, you know, sustainability plans for companies like, you know, Primark and Heathrow Airport and OVO Energy. And we're really proud of those. And then there's another bunch of our work, which is very much related to stakeholder engagement, mediation, acting as this bridge between campaign groups and companies. We've done a lot of that in deforestation, in palm oil in particular, pulp and paper. But for me, the fundamental principle of it all is just tell it how we see it and be direct, be honest. One of our clients said, you know, we speak the truth to power. And I'm just not interested in advising companies to tell them what they want to hear. I'm interested in working with companies who want to hear the difficult stuff, want to navigate the difficult stuff. And if they're serious, then we can do great things together. And if they're not serious, it's not going to work for them.
It leads to the other part of the question I want to ask you here. What have you had to do when you've had to walk away? What goes down in those situations? Because I think people would love to understand this, because it is often challenging to say no.
Yeah, so a couple of things on that. I mean, I'm not going to do a sort of laundry list of sort of dirty linen of who we've done that with, but we have often walked away before we've started. So we have said, you know, on that basis, we won't be able to help you because what you're asking is something that we are unwilling to do. It's not going to work for you anyway. Good luck with that. So normally we find ourselves walking away before it begins. But there have been instances, and there continue to be instances, where, you know, if we take a view that, frankly, the advice isn't being listened to, or that the company is kind of using us as a bit of a blanket, if you like, could be because they don't want us to work for a competitor, could be because they think having our name on their books as an advisor in some way validates their approach. But if they're not really taking the advice, we will say to them that this isn't really working, and we'll stop. You know, the reality is that there's a lot of narrative, old consultancies just take anyone's money and they, you know, it's all about targets and goals and bonuses. I'm afraid in our case, it's complete nonsense. There is tons of work to go around. The sustainability industry is not short of work. So you can be quite picky these days if you want to be. And we are, you know, we won't take anyone's money just because we think, you know, it's not a commercial imperative for us. You know, people think, well, they can't drop that client because it's probably 30% of their income or whatever. It's just not, it's not the case. So We're, and I don't want to sound arrogant about it, but, you know, I get very irritated when people think that we might be in something because it's lucrative. Because, like I say, there is plenty of work out there.
Yeah, it's so true. There is more work than we have people available to do it in this space. That is for sure. And it's so broad. I just want to like recap on some of the takeaways, because I think it's not, a lot of people that have come across, they do find themselves in these situations. So be really clear on what the ask is. Make sure that you're really clear on what the objective and the intent is of whoever it is that you're working with this space. And I think touching on a topic that you said, having the ability to speak to power, or having the ability to say no to power, I think you've also got to do that in terms of anyone that you might be collaborating with in this space as well, is an important takeaway for a few people. Which is probably, you know, I want to shift into gears into Asia. Right, because you guys have just opened offices in Singapore and Asia after you've had a really long standing in Europe and the Middle East. We know that there's a ton of activity taking place in Asia. I've personally been living here for 8 years. I have to admit at the time, never in my wildest dreams that I imagined I'd be living in, working in Asia, and here I am 8 years later. And where we were 8 years ago, I would say the market almost wasn't ready, whereas now we're in a very different space. We're seeing a lot of frameworks. We've seen a lot of development coming out of this region. So it'd be great to understand Robert's Bridge perspective on Asia. Like, why now? What are you seeing in this region that you think will be really beneficial in the sustainability space?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's the most interesting region of the world in which to do all this stuff. Like you know, we've been working in that region for about a decade, so slightly longer. We began on the deforestation debate. To be honest, back then it was a handful of companies who were really protecting their license to operate because they were under huge supply chain pressures from European and American customers who were increasingly under pressure from NGOs over supply chain sourcing of palm and pulp and paper and so on. It's completely different now. It is much less a reactive, defensive, knee-jerk, panic-driven response, and it is about embracing net zero, the future. Why has that changed? Couple of reasons. One is, in the last few years, virtually every government on earth has signed up to some form of net zero because they see the enormous climate risks which are now upon us, which frankly could have been tackled a bit earlier, but they weren't, and here we are. So the political environment has changed, and governments come and go in various countries, and some governments are more committed to net zero than others, and then they have an election and it changes. But the trajectory is very clear, and Southeast Asia is absolutely no exception. Everybody has net zero goals. Singapore, as you know, has very ambitious, you know, green leadership position for the region and for itself. Indonesia has a net zero target. You know, this is, China has a net zero target. So we can argue about 2050, 60, 70, but the trajectory is very, very clear. The other big difference, and this is, I think, even more recent, is the investment community. Now, I am not a fan of the phrase ESG. I think it's become a sort of box-ticking kind of parlance that can be almost meaningless. However, it is the acronym which has captivated the investment sector and allowed it finally to embrace this triple bottom line thinking, which it willfully ignored for about 30 years, because the triple bottom line is nothing new. As you know, if you've ever read a book on the history of sustainability, it's a pretty old concept, environmental social governance. But here we are. And of course, it's had a huge impact on companies. And the most interesting development for me, when I think about when I started and now, is this. When we used to work in this sector, the two stakeholders that you could guarantee would never meet or have a conversation were campaigners and investors. So if you imagined, you know, if you were Unilever or Nestle, you would talk to your shareholders in one series of conversations, and you would have completely different parallel kind of track with the stakeholder, you know, fluffy NGO world. Now the NGOs are talking directly to the investors, and the company isn't even in the room. You know, yeah. They're like the roadkill. And so companies, and I'm sure Microsoft, your company, is no different, are getting questionnaire after questionnaire, which has been written by investors in dialogue with NGOs who are telling them what to ask. This is a complete game changer for sustainability. And I believe it is the reason not only that more and more companies are embracing sustainability, but more and more of them want to race each other to derive, you know, financial advantage from it. And that we used to say, you know, 10 years ago, oh, it's a great commercial advantage to being in sustainability. To be honest, we didn't have very much to back it up, and it was a little bit kind of yurt chat. But now there really is. And access to capital, you know, is the game changer here. And there are surprising entities who you would not necessarily put on a list of green investment firms who are pulling funding from projects because they don't meet the environmental or social criteria that they expect. This is really, really new, but it's absolutely vital.
Yeah, I do. That's probably one of the biggest things I've seen too, is the expectations and the framing around any kind of investment, and then also decisions that have been made in terms of proceeding with different, I guess you could say, infrastructure projects or projects relating to sustainable assets.
And to your point about Asia, you know, Asia is both a huge financial hub, you know, Singapore, Hong Kong in particular, but also, you know, you can't deliver global net zero without Southeast Asia. It is not possible. You cannot do it. So much of what the West consumes comes from Asia. Look at the energy mix in Southeast Asia, the dependence on coal, which is for historic and economic reasons, and it's a legitimate reason. But if we're going to do net zero, the idea that you can do it without Southeast Asia is la-la land. And that links back to your question about should we work on difficult stuff or not. If I say, do you know what, we are never going to work with a fossil fuel company or a company that is dependent on fossil fuels, I can shut down Singapore and Jakarta and Dubai immediately. And then what will we have achieved? Nothing. I can go and work with a load of organic makeup brands in Britain if I want. They do not need my help.
You know, you've just put my thinking track into three different trajectories there in terms of what we can talk about. So, I mean, even from the Asia perspective, when you're talking about net zero, because it's also more about net zero when you think about everything that takes place in Asia in terms of supply chain, what takes place with water, nature reserves, a whole lot. Even on the net zero piece, just companies that touch and tap into that have got like a $1 trillion opportunity, you know, not wanting to make it about the money, but this is the opportunity that companies have that really lean into it. And that's just scratching the surface on the net zero piece. That's not all the other elements that come into sustainability. I think also it is that really nice, I guess, lead into the difficulty and the controversy of this industry and working in this space. And you just touched on that and the reasons why you've come into Asia. And just as a note for the listeners and coming from a sustainability practitioner perspective, there's a really fine line between what we've achieved in sustainability, because a lot has been achieved and there's been a lot of great progress, but we are still way off the mark, as Brendan's obviously talking about here too. And greenwashing definitely exists. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. And what's important is how we work with it and how we work with some of these challenging industries. The thing that I want to focus on is what's been really progressive. So where we see companies that are going, hey, we're far from perfect. We've still got a massive learning journey to do here, but we've been transparent. We're sharing our lessons learned. We're being co-collaborative in what we need to solve here with governments, industries, NGOs, a whole lot. And they're really demonstrating their leadership and accountability in this space. And I think that's what's important, being able to say we're not perfect, we're not there yet, but this is what we're doing and this is what we're trying to change and how we're bringing people along. I think the market's still quite mixed. We do still have companies that are simply ticking the box versus those that are really driving this accountability and change in this space. So I just want to get your point of view on this, because, you know, there are implications in terms of working with these really tricky businesses, or these really tricky industries, I should say, rather than businesses. There is a lot of greenwashing that does take place, but then also I think sometimes companies that are really genuinely trying to make the best impact and be really open and honest about that, even though they're not there, do sometimes get caught up in a lot of the tensions that are in this space. So I'd really like to understand and hear your point of view on this, and what are your experiences that you've seen on your journey so far?
I think we should take, you know, one of the biggest Southeast Asian examples as a bit of a case study, and that's the palm oil industry. You know, the palm oil industry is a really, you could write books, well, people are writing books on it, but it's a very interesting case study because, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it became almost the poster child for everything that's wrong with the world, right? You know, deforestation, orangutans, Western greed, it was all done for dietary and health reasons. You know, that's why people were encouraged to switch to palm oil in food products. It became this kind of gold rush, and we know what the consequences of that were. And you had four or five very large family-owned conglomerates who made great copy for Greenpeace reports and viral ads. And, you know, you thought, my God, this is worse than big oil. You know, this is horrendous. And when you look at what has happened over the last 10 to 15 years in that sector. It is quite remarkable in terms of companies that once, you know, would not go near an NGO, really thought they were terrorists and how dare they, you know, scrutinize our company in this way. All of the big palm oil players, you know, one can have one's favorites and who's quicker and who's slower and who's been the best and who's not so good, as they say. But that sector has transformed itself in terms of transparency, in terms of no deforestation commitments, in terms of its social and human rights policies, its dashboards, the way you can see the grievances against those companies on particular landscapes, particular communities. Yeah, a level of transparency that, frankly, very few other sectors, you know, deploy. And we are starting to see, and please do not think that I'm saying for a minute that industry is sorted, job done, thanks very much. But we are starting to see that the levels of deforestation for palm oil in places like Indonesia have leveled off. There is still deforestation, there is still encroachment, there are still challenges with community conflict and with forest fires and so on. I get all of that. But by and large, you would have to say that the palm oil sector is something of a success story in terms of sorting itself out. And not just, again, in that reactive, defensive way, but is now seriously engaging in what does a biodiversity and nature strategy look like? What are the remedies for past harm? What does conservation and restoration need to mean? What's the formula? How do we help smallholders in our supply chain? You know, these are big questions, but all of the big players are dealing with it. So it shows, you know, what can be done. And you will still, I'm sure, find palm oil companies that do greenwash, but it's not really the big ones. And they're also listening to their customers and working with their customers, you know, who often have suspended or delisted them. And the net result of all that has been that as an industry, it has really, really moved in the right direction. Now, we need to do that in rubber. We need to do it in soy. We need to do it in other commodities that have been less advanced. There's been some very good work done on cocoa, particularly in terms of the social aspects of the supply chain, companies like Mars and Nestle and others. But again, there's a lot more work to do there. But it shows that when a sector wants to move, it can. And I remember the days where the palm oil industries and indeed the customers of the palm oil industry said, no, it's far too complicated. You can't trace palm oil. It's a very complicated supply chain. You don't understand how it works. It's impossible to trace. Of course you can trace it. You can trace anything at all. And we knew you could trace it because you have to be able to trace ingredients for food safety for when there's a sudden health risk because something's become contaminated. You can trace anything you like is the truth of it. If there is the will, the system, and the investment. That's what the palm oil industry was forced to do, and it's done it. It's now, though, important that they get rewarded for doing that commercially. And there's no point in companies saying, we want sustainable palm oil, but we're not going to pay for it. And that's the next big theme, you know, because if you want a palm oil company to go and replant half a rainforest, somebody does have to pay for that. But I think it's a good case study, and it's not the only one. And there are big efforts now going on in the aviation industry on sustainability in a number of sectors. You know, the race for renewables and in your sector, you know, the energy demand of all those servers and these huge impacts that companies like Microsoft have. But you know, you are working on it. You know, and again, 10 years ago, nobody was really demanding that you did. And you too can derive commercial advantage from it. And you are doing, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I was about to say, when you were talking about traceability, I can vouch for all the technology that's available to make that possible and very simply and easily too, right? I think also what you were describing, there's so much differences also from what we've seen 10 years ago to now. And I like to call it is being brave enough to have the conversations that matter, because if you actually have that conversation with these industries, that's where we see these big transformation that takes place. And I'll give even like a classic example back in Perth, Western Australia, where I'm from, which is really big in the mining and also in the oil and gas industry. So there's a big downstream impact on communities if we eradicated industries. But also like when, you know, this is an example going back 15 years ago and there was videos showing against some of these industries and the work they were doing. But equally, the people that were really vocalised towards it, which they're fully in their right to be vocalised and against it, they're also wearing like jewellery and metal and all these sorts of things. They go, that's coming from the companies that right now you're also proactively trying to work against what you're trying to say they're doing wrong. So I think there's also the accountability that we all need to understand what we're all engaging with and using on a day-to-day basis does have these impacts. So what's really important is how we're engaging with these industries to have the right kind of conversations, to almost be curiously compassionate, for another way of explaining it, to then say there has to be a better way. And what do we need to do to be working at the forefront of some of these industries?
I couldn't agree more. And you know, one of the, and this is increasingly a theme, partly because of our merger with Stonehaven that you mentioned, because they do a lot of data work on citizen attitudes and so on. And you have to embrace this in a way that carries people with you, because particularly as the climate, you know, when I started in all this, you know, climate didn't feature in general elections in political discourse. The environment was like issue number 12 or 13. And even then it was about your local playground or something. It wasn't global stuff like we're dealing with now. And you know that in Australia, elections have become very much about carbon taxes and climate change in the last few years. In the UK, net zero is an electoral issue now. And in America, huge divide between sort of the Democrats and the Republicans on climate change issues and global action. The truth is that if you don't carry citizens with you and find the right messaging for them, it is terribly easy for politicians who would rather none of this existed at all to dismantle it all. Not a problem in countries that aren't democracies, but it's a major problem in countries that are. And therefore, you have to be very, very careful that what you do doesn't switch people off the agenda and, if you like, drag them into sort of culture wars that associate climate action with a whole bunch of other things they may not like, you know, the so-called woke agenda or whatever they want to call it, because we could all be roadkill in that if we're not careful. And, you know, if you want to get people to switch to hybrid or electric vehicles, or you want to get people to eat less meat and dairy, or you want them to change away from aviation to rail for short-term trips, whatever it is you're asking, whatever the nudge is that you require for your net zero strategy, if the public becomes hostile to it, you know, you'll lose the ability, you'll lose your agency to do any of that. And I think, you know, historically, I probably haven't recognized that quite enough. I've been a bit like, listen, we'll sort it for you, don't worry. But it doesn't really work. And supermarkets will tell you as well, when they have tried to reformulate products, you know, to reduce fat or sugar or salt or whatever, it's all very well, but if nobody buys the product because they don't like how it tastes, you haven't really achieved anything. So you've got to be really, really careful. And I don't think one should be led by, you know, the kind of short-term impulses of focus groups and polls and voters. You are onto a losing wicket if you think you can ignore these issues, because there's a whole part of citizenship which is massively keen on this whole agenda, and there are plenty of populist politicians who will happily ride that wave. So you've got to be really careful.
I think everything you just described there, it talks about the complexity of everything that we're dealing with in this space. There's no simple pathway. There is no simple solution. It's also getting that collective, I guess you could say, spirit of getting everybody along on the journey too. And I think the reality is even some of the great stuff that we're seeing today that we're celebrating, it's still probably not enough, right? So for the people that are really invested and really engaged, there's still not enough that's being done. But there's always going to be so much that can be done. So I think one thing I want to touch on with you here is, we know it's not easy. We know we're years down the line of all these people that are really trailblazing and doing some great work in this space. We're still not quite there in terms of all the measuring, the reporting, and most importantly, some of the transformation we need to see taking place. We've seen some really great things, but we've also got a while to go. What for you, since 2010, when you started Roberts Bridge, what for you have you seen as the biggest change from then to now? And what makes you the most optimistic?
I think it would have to be, if I had to pick one, it would have to be the focus of investors on the on these issues, you know, which I was talking about earlier. The fact that finance is no longer delinked from the sustainability agenda. There is no longer this this battle. I mean, there's still a difference of emphasis and approach, and I'm not saying the entire banking sector is now fully on board with this and has abandoned all short-term quarterly profits as a metric. But the truth of it is, because of risk and risk to capital and insurance costs and all of these huge costs that are piling up if we don't stabilize the climate and if we don't protect nature, the investment community has got that message because they are the people who are going to lose out. And there's nothing like a bunch of bankers feeling their capital might be at risk to get stuff done. And it you know, it's not the only change that's happened, but I would have to say it's the single biggest change is the engagement of the financial markets on these issues.
You know, I would agree with that because there was a time over 10 years ago where customers, and we're talking about big impactful global brands who were already in sustainable development. We were already looking at full circular economies within their own business. And to get any kind of capital funding relating to that sustainability project that they're looking at, obviously different for other parts of the business, but anything that was sustainability related, they'd have to actually self-fund and find that funding through those mechanisms. So I would say, yeah, that's definitely one of the biggest parts of that's changed is the financial sector, but also I guess the green economy frameworks that are coming through. So all the investment that's driving what's taking place in the carbon development and the industry transition funds or industry transition, I should say. I think though, probably where there is a gap, I talked about it on the last podcast, where there's probably still a 5 to 10% shortfall to emerging nations on financial investment, unfortunately, but that needs to be fixed in the, I guess you could say, the immediate future for all the adaptation plans that need to take place.
And I think Singapore can be absolutely at the forefront of that, you know, with its rich history of sovereign wealth and the way it has deployed its capital strategically, you know, arguably you could say, not for these issues in the past, but now, you know, tilting towards the future and net zero and using that sovereign wealth, you know, to do these big, difficult investments that need to happen. I think it's really exciting, you know, for Singapore in particular. And then the opportunities for countries like Indonesia, you know, this huge potential carbon sink, so many agricultural commodities coming from there. You know, these are big opportunities, energy transition, unbelievable opportunity for Indonesia, but it's got to be done in a way that works. And I that's why I'm so excited about the region, you know, because I think, you know, Europe has signed up to net zero. It's doing its thing. At the moment, the US administration is being quite ambitious on it, much more than the previous one. And let's hope that that lasts and isn't all derailed, you know, in a couple of years' time. But, you know, where I see the most concerted footprint and effort to address it is in Southeast Asia. You know, and that's why we are investing so much and putting an office on the ground in Jakarta, staffed by Indonesians, building a presence in Singapore, you know, and working in Malaysia. And we hope over time, you know, we'll do it. We're not going to run before we can walk, but you know, really embrace that region because it's really where the action's going to be.
No, I agree. And I've got to admit, like from a practitioner perspective, anyone that's worked in this industry for a long time, like from a personal perspective, I have times that I'm super energized and really optimistic. And then there's other times I'm on a doom scroll spiral, going, oh my gosh, where are we going? And when I see what's taking place in Asia right now, even compared to 8 years ago, it is so incredibly exciting. It actually makes me optimistic and energized in a way that perhaps I wasn't even before, despite having been in this industry for so long. And I look at, you know, everything we've talked about in this discussion, from the supply chain challenges to the industries that we're dealing with in this part of the world, all the way through to what we're doing in terms of investments and NGOs. I think we've really got, because we've got different challenges to what EMEA needs to be dealing with. So, and also look at what's taking place with technology in this space, how we've got hubs in Singapore and Indonesia and then also in China in terms of startups. I do really believe that we've got a great opportunity in Asia to leapfrog a lot of these challenges and to really accelerate some of the problem solving and co-collaboration that needs to take place to solve some of the bigger challenges that we're still dealing with in decarbonisation, for example, and supply chains, I think a lot of the answers are going to be lying in the trickiness of some of the challenges we deal with in the Asia market.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I spend more and more of my time there. I think it's just a brilliant place to do this stuff.
Yeah. So on that note, Brendan, we've covered you. We've talked about Roberts Bridge. We've talked about the difficult challenges of the industry, the controversies, also your journey on this space and Roberts Bridge journey in this space, and why we're so excited about what we're doing here. Anything else you want to share with the listeners? If there's one thing you want listeners to take away from this conversation, what would that be?
Keep going. Just keep going. keep making the case. The news headlines are not going to get any better on this stuff, and we have to move fast. I think half of the battle is arming people, I guess, like you, internally, with the weaponry that they need to keep achieving within their companies. You know, there's always people within companies who are a bit skeptical about this or think there's no advantage to doing it. And, you know, a lot of our work is arming people internally to help make that case. And that's fine. You know, it's necessary. And not to be disheartened, you know, it is not too late. These issues can be fixed. You know,
yeah.
I grew up with acid rain and a hole in the ozone layer. And all my school projects were about acid rain in Germany and the hole in the ozone layer. Well, they sorted that out, didn't they, with the Montreal Protocol. So these things can be done. And therefore, we've just got to keep going. I think the biodiversity and nature agenda has always been a bit the poor cousin of climate change. That can't continue. They operate as twins. And I think nature and nature-based solutions, you know, for all the rap they get, that's going to be a vital part of the toolbox. I don't think we can afford to just chuck things like that in the bin. And remember, there's nuance here. This is not all black and white. It is not all carbon offsetting is bad. All, you know, non-renewable energy should be shut down tomorrow morning. This is not how any of this is going to work. So I think we have to accept there are nuances and there are going to be difficult conversations. And crucially, there are going to be trade-offs because we've left all this about 40 years too late. So the idea now there are perfect roadmap choices, I'm afraid, is a fantasy. So if we want, for example, to electrify the global economy, we're going to need more metal. We're going to have to look at where that comes from and we're going to have to make some difficult decisions. Or we won't do the metal at all, in which case we won't electrify the global economy. So these are tricky things. You know, we can't just shut down all carbon offsetting because people who once liked it now don't, and because not all of it is perfect. We can't go palm oil free, you know, neither should we, because other forms of oil could be far more damaging. So these unintended consequences we have to be really careful of now. But there's tons of opportunity, there's tons of work to do ahead. Anyone who wants to come into this sector, you know, will be welcome with open arms. And there's, like I said, there's more than enough work to go around. So this is a growth economy.
Yeah, there is so much to do, that's for sure. So thank you so much, Brendan. Thanks for joining us and for being so generous with your thoughts and your time. And this has been great. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun to do this with you, Brendan.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did having the chance to interact with the guests today. If you have any pressing topics that you'd love to hear more about in sustainability, because you're going to hear through this podcast there, it's not simple, it's complex, it's very broad. So any topics that you would love to hear more about, please reach out, say hello, and we'll see what we can do to get them on the future podcast. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the British Chamber of Commerce Singapore's podcast channel. Before you go, don't forget to subscribe and why not leave us a rating and review on Spotify, Apple, Google and the other podcast platforms. For more information about the Chamber, please visit our website at www.britcham.org.sg and tune in next time for a brand new episode.